Hi, and welcome to the wonderful podcast, Living Yoga Off the Mat. I am Wanda Batwal. I'm looking forward to explore with you the fascinating world of yoga, spirituality, and personal development. To hear and to learn how we can integrate more love, balance, and fulfillment in our daily lives. Welcome to Wonderful. I'm so happy that you're here. Hey, 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 and welcome to this week's episode. I'm so glad that you're here. I am super excited to introduce to you this week's guest. I speak to my dear friend, Light Watkins, who I actually got to know back in Bali when I was living there several years ago. Light and me met up in New York by coincidence when I was visiting there in January. Well, the thing is, I don't believe in coincidences, and I believe in good timing of the universe, and I believe in manifestation. So guess what? Light has been on my list of people I wanted to speak to and interview for a while. So I am super grateful that this worked out so amazingly and I got to share this podcast with you. So thank you, universe. And thank you, Light, for coming into this podcast. If you don't know Light yet, well, you will get to know him now. Light Watkins is a Vedic meditation teacher, a speaker, and best-selling author. He has been practicing and teaching meditation since 1989. So let me count. Yes, that's over 20 years ago. Wow. So he's obviously a very experienced meditation practitioner and teacher, and he has been teaching thousands of people how to meditate, from grandmothers to dentists, to people whose movies you have seen and whose music you have listened to. And right now, Light travels the world giving talks on happiness, mindfulness, and meditation, as well as leading retreats and trainings. In this podcast, you will learn more about Light's personal path towards meditation, what I was actually super keen on. Light clarifies for us what Vedic meditation actually is all about and how this practice works, and the benefits of a regular meditation practice on our health and how it lowers our stress level. He also shares with us why uncertainty is one of his personal daily routines, creating a life of uncertainty, and why it's actually not so good for us to get too comfortable in one place. And last but not least, we speak about the importance of finding our purpose and life's mission in order to contribute and give back to this world. I am super happy now to share with you this conversation with the amazing Light Watkins. Enjoy. So welcome, Light Watkins. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation today.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me on. I'm really excited.
Me too. So would you be so kind to lead us into a little transitioning, arriving meditation, just to transition from where we're coming from into this moment?
Okay. Sure, we can do that. Okay, let's do this. Obviously, if you're listening to this while you're driving, you don't want to close your eyes. Or maybe you pull over and close your eyes. Everyone else close their eyes and sit in a comfortable fashion. And we'll start with just taking a few deep breaths in and out of the nose. So take a deep breath in, fill the lungs all the way up, pause at the top, and exhale everything out. Nice. Let's do that again. Deep breath in. And release. Okay. One more time. Biggest breath in. Pausing at the top. And then let it go. Keeping the eyes closed. And just feeling your body. Feeling your legs, your seat, feeling yourself grounded where you are, and just noticing the sensations, noticing the sounds, the tastes, the feelings, any distinct smells, aromas in this moment, and just bringing your awareness into the moment. And it's fine if we happen to move back to the future, or, and it's happened, it's fine if we happen to go back to the future or back to whatever happened earlier today, but when you remember, just come back to the moment and just be here now. Connect it to your body, connect it to your breathing, connect it to your sensations. And with the intention of being as judgment-free as possible. In other words, if it feels like, oh, my mind is very busy, that's okay. If it feels like I'm a little achy, that's okay. If it feels like it's a little noisy where I am, that's okay. Right? Everything is okay. We don't have to label it. We don't have to categorize it. We don't have to judge it whatsoever. And so from that space, I want you to slowly open your eyes and be fully available for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Light.
You're welcome. I don't get a chance to guide a lot of meditations, so it was nice to have that opportunity. I've actually, out of all the podcasts that I've done, I've never actually started one with meditation. So already we're charting new
new ground.
Yeah.
So right now we're sitting here in a small flat in New York, and probably you can hear all these noises in the background, which I find charming.
It's very New York. Yeah.
It's very New York. And last time we saw each other was actually in Bali. That's where we met, right? And you're moving quite a lot. You're, as you say, a nomading meditation teacher. Mm-hmm. And my first question is, so obviously you're moving, you know, you're traveling, but what moves you inside right now?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I made a choice or a decision with myself about probably like 20 years ago. I'm 46 now. And I remember in my mid to late 20s having a conversation with myself. I had a lot of, you know, tumultuous relationship stuff happen around that time and a lot of uncertainty, and I was trying to kind of force things to happen. I was actually in the fashion industry. I was modeling, and you know, you're young, and so you try to like do everything you can to make things happen. And I remember reading some spiritual books and deciding that I'm going to just relentlessly follow my heart. I figured that if I can follow my heart, the money and the stuff and the relationships and all the things that I thought that I wanted were going to come to me in the most amazing and surprising ways. And instead of me trying to make those things happen and then following my heart when it was convenient to do so. So I started doing it back then, and now here we are 20 years later, and it's just, it feels like that's just kind of my status quo, if you will. So that I would say what moves me is whatever's happening on the heart level. And I don't really question it anymore. I just, if it says, you know, go out and get some flowers, or go and, you know, take a different route to your appointment than the one you were initially planning to take, I just do it. I don't think about it. And I found that when I do it, really remarkable things tend to happen, meaning things that happen that are worthy of remarking about throughout the day. And I think we all kind of have that experience, you know, when coincidences or we have serendipitous moments, those become the storylines of our day and our week. Like, can you believe what happened? I thought about this person and they called me. Like, everybody loves that. And that just happens all the time, I find, when you follow your heart.
Beautiful. So you started a little bit taking us with you into your past. You said 20 years ago, you were modeling, you know, and most people start on this path of meditation, of yoga, self-development, self-exploration, not from the motivation because they're so happy, right? Because something is moving them, something, maybe they hit a wall, or there was a wake-up call in some way, yeah, a loss or an accident or something happen for most people, you know. Most people come onto this inner path because of some kind of suffering. Mm-hmm. So would you tell us a little bit, what was it for you that brought you onto this inner path?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was at a retreat that I was facilitating about a couple years ago down in Peru, and the guy that was running the center, we were having dinner one night, and he asked me the same question. He said, you know, you're a meditation teacher, and that's great. He goes, well, did you have like a dark night of the soul? Mm-hmm. Was there like some really crazy thing that happened that kind of shifted your path? And honestly, I that wasn't my experience. It's not to say that I've had an easy life, although I've had a fairly happy experiences in life. But I would say that the thing that got me most interested in this path is curiosity. I've always been really a curious person. And my mother actually used to, she commented that when I was a kid, she would spank me a lot because I would always break the toys that she would give me. And she realized after some time that it wasn't that I was purposely destroying things. It's just that I wanted to see how they worked. I was always curious about how things worked. And so as I got older, the toy that I wanted to see how it worked became these sort of inner practices, right? I started with yoga, and that was interesting. And then, of course, when you're in the yoga space, everybody makes reference to meditation. You know, yoga is a preparation for meditation. So then you...
Hopefully,
yeah. And then you start scratching the surface of that, and you start to see these images of, you know, guys sitting in caves and wearing robes and, you know, walking around naked with ashes on their body. And you're like, what's that all about? And you dig deeper, and then you start to learn about the Vedas and all of different systems of yoga and meditation. And so it just kept intriguing me to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And I would say that was the most, that was the thing that was most responsible for me getting into the path that I'm on now. It's just my own curiosity. And also not letting kind of quote unquote normal things stand in the way, right? I got my first job out of college in advertising. And I knew within a few months that, you know, this, I looked around the office and it was a great job. It was like my dream job that I always wanted to get. And it was in the creative department. And I would show up, you know, before the office opened and leave, be the last person to leave because I love the work. But when I looked around and I saw the people who had been there the longest, nobody really seemed to be all that happy. It's like they were on this sort of treadmill waiting for the next thing to happen, the next promotion, the next vacation, the next deal, the next pitch. And I just kind of did the math and thought, you know, I don't want to be locked into this thing 10 years from now, feeling like, oh my God, I've become that person waiting for the next thing to happen. And now I'm too deep into it and I can't go anywhere because I have a family or have this or that. And so now I have to like kind of keep going in this direction because I'm already too invested. I didn't want to be invested in something like that. So, and I wasn't meditating or anything or doing yoga back then, but something inside just told me, look, quit the job and just start traveling around and just live a life of uncertainty. And that's the answer. And I didn't have that language. I would have never been able to articulate that in that way back then, but I just listened to it. And that's kind of how I got into the modeling industry, is from quitting my first job, because I leaned into uncertainty. And I found that that's really the thing that kept me curious and excited about all of these other things that came a lot later. And if I wasn't in a position to make a move really quickly, I probably would not have been able to invest the amount of time into my yoga and meditation practice that I originally did.
So you are a Vedic meditation teacher. Mm-hmm. Would you describe a little bit, how did it come that you chose this kind of meditation practice? Mm-hmm. So perhaps also who was your teacher, who is your teacher, mm-hmm. and also what type of meditation that is for the ones listening who have no idea what Vedic meditation is about.
Sure. So, I like the distinction of the idea that meditation, there are different paths, because a lot of people treat meditation as the same thing, and there are 1,000 ways to meditate. And if you ask 1,000 people, how do you meditate, you'll get 1,000 different answers. So I always tell people I didn't really choose Vedic meditation. It chose me. And what I mean by that is, when I was trying out a lot of different styles of meditation, I didn't quite feel at home. And it wasn't until I met my Vedic meditation teacher, and I was invited to, in fact, it was 17 years ago this week, I was invited to an apartment in West Hollywood, California, to listen to a talk about meditation. I had no idea what to expect. I was really just going along because my good friend was hosting it and I wanted to support him. I never thought in a million years that I would get anything of value out of that session. And when I showed up and the teacher came out from the back, I noticed that the teacher had what I was looking for in that office, in that advertising office. He had that sense of happiness that I didn't even know existed until I met him. And I was like, that's it. That's what I've been looking for. This is it. I'm home. And I would have learned anything he had to teach. And it wasn't like he was sitting there with a big smile plastered on his face or anything like that. He just seemed content. He seemed fulfilled in a way that I'd never seen anybody have that level of inner happiness. So I already knew that he was going to become my teacher.
What was his name?
His name is Tom Knowles. Tom Knowles, American man, but he'd studied with his Indian teacher over in India for many years, and he'd been traveling around the world teaching people to meditate from all walks of life. So I started becoming his protege. And after about 4 years, he invited myself and some of his other protégés over to India to train us to become meditation teachers, which was really exciting because this is back in 2006, so there weren't a whole lot of meditation teachings happening around the world. There was no apps, there was no YouTube, there was no Google, there was just analog experiences. And I felt like I was in this sort of secret society where people were really enjoying this practice, and the community was budding and building, and it was just fun. And so I went to India, learned how to teach meditation in the same way that I was trained by my teacher, which was a 4-day course of instruction, a couple hours a day. And the thing that makes it distinct from other styles, the Vedic style, the Vedic meditation style is known as a householder style of meditation, which means meditation that is intended for non-monastic people. So instead of sitting with your back straight, with your legs crossed, like you would do in a yoga class, you're actually encouraged to sit with back support and to have your legs and your arms at ease as if you were watching Netflix or something. And so right off the bat, when you sit like that, the meditation feels a lot more relaxed and comfortable. And then you find that your mind can actually settle a lot faster that way. And then you have a mantra that you get from the teacher that you can use in meditation in a very passive way to allow the mind to kind of drop in a lot faster. And so you can get to a point in the meditation where you're literally not thinking about anything. It feels like a drug, actually. And you just want to keep going longer and longer and longer. But the teacher says, you have to keep it at 20 minutes because there is a such thing as over meditation with this particular style. So 20 minutes twice a day is the recommended dosage. And it became this thing that I did every day, like clockwork. And I've been doing it now 17 years and teaching it for 13 years. And I've got an opportunity. I've had an opportunity to work with thousands of people, and everyone has the same experience that I had. And so it's a wonderful thing. And I feel like I'm living a dream.
Just to be clear, it's not
transcendental meditation.
Transcendental meditation, right? It's not, right?
Well, what's interesting is my teacher was a transcendental meditation teacher for many years. But when he left the organization, that's a whole other podcast conversation. But they reached out to him and they said, look, you can keep teaching meditation. You can't call it transcendental meditation because that's a trademark thing in America and we'll sue you and all of these kinds of things. So he started teaching under the Vedic meditation, but the basis of what he taught, and I don't know if it's the same thing because I've never actually taken a transcendental meditation course, but I know the roots of both TM and VM both come from India, from this same teacher that he had.
Yeah, so they are related, you can say.
Yeah, they're cousins. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you have made it your goal, or one of your goals, to give real people, as you say it, yeah, who have a real job, mm-hmm. and easy access to meditation, mm-hmm. right? And also to clean up, you know, with some misconceptions and myth about meditation, and, you know, the excuses also why people can't meditate. So would you be so kind to just, you know, sum up a little bit of the myth that people think about meditation, the people listening who are not meditating or having a hard time with meditation? What are like the common, you know, conceptions about meditation?
Yeah. So when I say real people with real jobs, who I'm referring to are, you know, we have this idea in our mind of the type of person that would be really good at meditation. And a lot of people would describe that person as maybe someone who has a robe on, someone who's soft-spoken, someone who's a vegetarian, someone who doesn't care a lot about recreational things, right? Someone without kids, or, you know, these kinds of ideas. And it's a big misconception. That person in our mind usually is more of a monastic type of person, and they're are meditation styles that are best suited for those kinds of people. And for everyone else who may like the idea of meditating, but you also like the idea of being in a relationship and having a family and, you know, having a job and paying your bills and being responsible and all the other things, watching football, you don't have the same time commitment that a monk would have. And what happens is a lot of those people, the regular people, I call them, they try the monastic approach to meditation. And because the priority levels are different, right? The monk has nothing else they want to do all day except for meditate. That regimen is going to feel more extreme to the regular person. So it won't be as accessible. And when I get a chance to work with the regular people, one of the things that they're most relieved about is that the practice is only 15 or 20 minutes, only once or twice a day, and it can fit in around all the other, picking up the kids from soccer practice and all the other things that they have going on. And it feels great and restful while they're doing it, so they don't have to contend with the what they call the monkey mind. Because that actually goes away once they learn the householder style of meditation. The monkey mind is really dominant when you're trying to do the monastic approach to meditation. And so it transforms from this activity that felt like a chore into one that feels actually like a delightful, enjoyable usage of your time and your energy. And so it's usually refreshing for people. And the best part about it, and this is what I appreciated about it the most when I first learned it from my teacher, is that it's not belief-based, it's not faith-based. When I first was dabbling in meditation, the guides and the facilitators would say, you know, just, you know, you have to have faith that, you know, everything is happening. It's good for you. But that wasn't the direct experience. And it wasn't until I met my teacher that I actually felt a tangible sense of rest and expansion and fulfillment inside while I was meditating, which was completely different from what I was experiencing before, where I just felt like I was sitting there staring at the back of my eyelids. So you didn't need someone to tell you to believe in it, because it was just, it felt great in the moment. And then that made you want to do it again and again and again. And that's what I discovered was the base, was the foundation for consistency, is it just has to feel good. Like anything else we do in life, the things that feel great, we don't have to convince ourselves or negotiate with ourselves to do it. We just we happily make the time to do it. It's the things that don't feel great that we have to barter with ourselves and have discipline and all of these kinds of approaches. So the myth is that you don't need discipline to meditate. You just need to meditate in the way that feels great, and that the discipline will already be there.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful. And also that there are many different styles,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, tons of different styles. And one doesn't negate another one, right?
Right.
They can all be legitimate based on your priorities.
Right, and what also fits for you.
Exactly.
And I think that's what many people don't know, actually, mm-hmm. that there are many different ways to meditate, right?
Right, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because some people will say, look, I like sitting with my back straight. I like having my legs crossed. And I say, great. All I care about is that you enjoy whatever you do. If you want to stand on your head with peanut butter on your face and you love that and you do it every day like clockwork, fantastic. Keep doing it. I'm working with people who have disqualified themselves from thinking they can meditate because they've tried those other things and it doesn't feel like anything is happening. That's who I like to work with. So, but if anyone else is doing anything else and it feels great, keep doing it.
So one of the things I hear often why people can't do yoga is that they're not flexible enough. Or they can't meditate because their mind is too busy.
Right.
So can you speak with us a little bit about the nature of the mind?
Yes. So if someone said, my mind is very, very relaxed and calm.
Congratulations.
And it would be perfect for meditation. That person would be weird. They would be, and not weird as in something is wrong with them. It would just be unusual, highly unusual, because most people feel that way. Everyone thinks I'm the only one who has a busy mind, but actually everybody's mind is technically busy. And by that, I mean, everyone is constantly thinking. When your eyes are open and you're in the waking state, which is what you're in while you're listening to this podcast, your mind is experiencing three thoughts a second, right? So 10 seconds goes by, that's 30 thoughts. Now, when your eyes are open and you're engaged in activity, you may not notice that 30 thoughts just kind of flew by in those 10 seconds. But when you close your eyes and you sit there for 10 seconds, those same 10 seconds can feel like 10 minutes, right? And what changed there was that you didn't have the benefit of your visual distraction. And so it felt like the volume on your mind just turned up, but really you just, the attention shifted from outside to inside, but it's the same number of thoughts, okay? But here's the thing. If most of your thoughts are creative and positive and optimistic, nobody's complaining, right? We only complain about negative thoughts, stressful thoughts, anxiety-ridden thoughts, right? Nobody's complaining about having too many happy thoughts. So it's not really a question of my mind is too busy. It's the quality of the thoughts that people are complaining about. Now, where do those negative, stressful thoughts come from, right? Is it coming from the mind or is it coming from somewhere else? And here's what I teach people when I'm getting them to understand the nature of the mind. The mind is really the outpicturing of what's leaving the body while you're meditating. In other words, if you're sitting there thinking negative, stressful thoughts, it's not because you have a negative, stressful, broken mind. It's that you've exposed your body to so much past stress and trauma that the body, under the influence of meditation, and this is a whole biochemical chain reaction of events, starts purging the now useless, unnecessary trauma, and it's leaving you through your mind. And so the reason why it feels like your mind is monkey, it's behaving like a drunk monkey, is because meditation is actually working, right? And so that's really the big aha that people have when they're learning how to meditate in my trainings, is that actually there's nothing wrong with your mind. It's actually a function of your body that's working better and better on your behalf. And how do you know this is happening? Because when you start meditating on a consistent basis, you're able to sleep better. Your body's able to digest food better. Your body's immune system gets stronger. Your hormones become more balanced. Your reproduction system starts to move back towards balance. So all of these things are happening, and these are real life practical concerns that people have, then people spend a lot of money trying to fix. But if your body has a lot of stress it's carrying around, you can take all the medication in the world. It's not really going to change things very much. So that's why they say meditation is one of the best natural interventions when it comes to healing the body and moving back towards balance, because it's an inside out job, and the stress can have a really debilitating effect on our health that it can be really expensive and time consuming if we just try to ignore that part and try to do the whole whack-a-mole, you know, outside in approach to healing ourselves. So the thoughts are just the price tag that you have to pay in order for the body to find its balance, and that just so happens to happen during the meditation process.
Really love that. What I recently understood is that the subconscious mind, you know, what you just said, like the purging that happens in meditation, that the subconscious mind's actually the whole body.
Yeah, there's no separation. Right, the mind is the body.
Right.
It's not just the brain. It's not just in the head.
Just to make that clear, because many people think that the mind is the brain.
It's the brain. No, it's the whole body. It's the whole body that's being positively influenced during the meditation. So like I said, the brain is like, if you look, imagine your body's like a radio or something like that. The brain is the speaker, right? It's just going to project whatever's you tune into in that moment. And so what meditation is doing is changing the channel away from all the static stuff into a kind of quieter frequency. But because it's a new practice for a lot of people, the body's algorithm keeps changing it back to the busy stuff, because that's where the body's used to kind of operating, right? And that's a function of stress. Stress locks us into a sort of, they call it the fight or flight mode. And so that comes with a host of emotions like anxiety and boredom and fear and sadness. All those emotions can be experienced in meditation. So on one hand, you have the conditioning, the subconscious conditioning of, oh my God, this experience, I know it's not going to work. Oh my God, da, 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 da. You know, all these concerns and worries that are just naturally how we approach anything that's new in our sort of waking state existence, because that's what we're used to doing. And then you have the release of the past stuff that it makes it feel exacerbated and feels like, oh, now it's even busier. Now there even more is happening. I knew it wasn't going to work, right? So there's two things happening. You're breaking down the old neural connections related to the past, and then you're building up new ones. And so the transition of the new stuff going in and the old stuff coming out makes it feel like I have a busy mind, when in actuality, your mind is just under renovation. You know, any building under renovation, there's a lot of commotion, there's a lot of dust, there's a lot of craziness, there's a lot of noise, but you just keep the camera rolling. Don't call off the contractor just yet. Just let them keep doing what they're doing. And then eventually you'll have this really beautifully constructed, rehabilitated body and mind.
Right. So you just spoke about, you know, you mentioned stress, anxiety, you know, panic attacks, depression, and the, I mean, you know that, like, the numbers of that are rising, you know, in globally, of people, you could say, who have a lot of trauma, you know, who experience a lot of fear. And so, as you said, meditation is one of the best ways to, yeah, to, what is the English word? So maybe you can help me, to prevent it.
Yeah.
Right. So what is your, I have a lot of, you know, ideas, but what are you observing, like, in people? Why do you think it's getting more and more intense globally?
Well, you know, when Kobe Bryant, the basketball player, died, and he and his daughter died in the helicopter crash a few days ago, within hours, everybody in the world knew about it because of social media, and we're in the information age, right? But then we also have the Australian fires that are happening. You also have whatever Trump is doing. You also have 1,000 other things that are happening around the world. And we find out about these things almost instantaneously. And we are empathetic creatures, which means you can't hear about something like, you know, some person and their daughter dying in some crazy accident without feeling something. And you can't see a picture of a koala bear with its paws burned from a fire without feeling empathetic about that. So it just compounds, because we're able to access all of this information so quickly, the emotional demand that's placed upon us compounds to a point where it becomes overwhelming, and it starts to diminish our ability to adapt to even just the things that are around us in the moment. So we don't feel like eating. We don't feel like, you know, doing the things that we need to do in order to keep things balanced in our life, because we're still empathizing with the things that are happening all around the world. And so that's the difference. If any of these things happened more than 100 years ago, it may take us weeks or days or maybe months before we figured it out. And then once we figured it out or learned about it, it would be over with, and there's nothing we can do about it. Right. But now we can respond quickly as well. And so that adds another layer of responsibility and a sense of purpose when we hear about these quote unquote bad things happening all around the world. So, you know, what we need to do is everything that we can to keep ourselves balanced. This is like when you fly in the airplane, and we've all heard this a million times, put the gas mask on yourself first before you help anyone else, right? There's going to be an emergency. There's going to be some trauma that happens. You can guarantee it. You know, every week there's going to be one or two things that happen that you weren't expecting to happen. And if you're not taking proactive measures to put the gas mask, the metaphorical gas mask, on yourself first, which could be yoga, could be your diet, eating well, could be exercise. All these are little gas masks that we need to be doing for ourselves so that we can make ourselves available to the changes and the demands and the pressures that are constantly placed upon us. Otherwise, they're going to feel too overwhelming. And the first thing that's going to go is the gas mask. And so then we may have the best intentions in the world, but we become a liability in those situations, because then people have to stop and take care of us, right? Mm-hmm. Which I don't think anybody really wants, but that's the only natural outcome from not taking care of yourself, is you become one of the things that people need to now have to stop and deal with.
Absolutely. Like, one of my teachers says, we cannot afford not to meditate.
Right.
Because
it's too expensive.
It's too expensive.
It's too expensive not to meditate.
Right. And I think that's, you know, because of the state of the world and that challenging times we live in, as you said, we get information in like the speed of light, and we are confronted by thousands of informations coming in every day, like so much. So I feel the balance, as you said, needs to be equally high to that what's coming in. Like, and it has changed. I mean, like the iPhone, it's so new, actually, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I remember like the iPhone, like how old is it? Like
it came out in 2003.
Like, yeah, yeah, something
exactly.
like that. So I feel also the interest in, you know, yoga, meditation, spirituality is growing because of that fast-paced growing information that's coming in. Right?
Well, that's what's exciting, you know, is
yeah, I think
being
so too.
alive in this time where there's a resurgence happening. There was one in the 60s and the 70s, but now it's resurging again, the meditation. And, you know, honestly, you have to credit a lot of these situations. Like I joke around, I'm not serious when I say this, but I joke around and I tell people I'm a big Trump supporter because nobody has driven more people to meditation than Donald Trump, Trump's antics, right? They stress people out and they feel like, okay, well, I need extra tools and let me go get a meditation, but you know, whatever it takes. So a lot of these things that are happening are the reason why more people are seeing quote unquote alternative wellness as the real wellness that I need to be doing, because that's going to keep me out of the operating room, right? Because that nobody wants to experience that. But you realize that I've got to do some preventative maintenance here, right? I do it with my car, I do it with my bicycle, I do it with my scooter, I do it with everything, my dog, but I don't do it with myself. And that's been the missing piece all along, is you can't just ingest all of this junk food, whether it's news, whether it's clickbait, you know, media, or any other, you know, alcohol or recreational drugs. That's junk food. You can't ingest it without having some negative effect or impact on your mind, body, and spirit. So meditation is the body's equivalent of eating vegetables and organic and, you know, drinking water and all of that, and you start to see that in the way that you feel less inclined to click on the article about whatever the Kardashians are up to, or you know, some other kind of thing that's not really adding value to your life. And that's again a big sign that, oh, it's working. So you may have a busy mind in meditation, but you're involving yourself less and less in gossip conversations, and you're feeling more inclined to follow your purpose and get out of dead-end relationships and let go of that soul-sucking job and stop doing stuff just for money and just because you're lonely, and all the kind of coping mechanisms that we have as a society. You know, a lot of that stuff is happening subconsciously, but you start to become more and more aware of it. And, you know, these are all stages in your own personal development and progress. And those are wonderful things. So you'll find that your inner work will help you be able to navigate that path. Because we're all on the path, whether we realize it or not. It's just that a lot of us are fighting it. And we're still thinking that the answer is outside of ourselves. And then ultimately, we get to a point where someone runs into someone like you or me, and we help them to see that actually the answer is found inside of yourself. And you really need to dedicate yourself to that. On some level, it needs to be a dedication, it needs to be a commitment, you need to be consistent with it, because the external forces are so strong, and the cultural indoctrination around the happiness being outside of yourself is so strong that even if you come to one class here and, you know, you read a book there, you're going to get sucked right back into that kind of dark hole of, you know, you got to go and make more money to be happy. And, you know, success is all about what kind of house you live in and what kind of car you drive. And if you look at the people who have accumulated the most things, you're not going to find happier people than you're going to be able to find in some village in India or Indonesia or some other place where people don't have anything, right? There's really no correlation between having billions of dollars and having nothing. It's really about what you're experiencing inside and the family you're around, and, you know, how grateful you are for what you have, and these kinds of intangible things that need to become more prioritized.
So what are some of your habits you created around next to meditation? Like, how does a typical day if there is such a thing. Like, but what are like some habits that you created that, you know, support you? What are your little gas mask?
Well, one thing I've done in the last couple of years is I've become nomadic. And what I mean by that is I got rid of my apartment. I had this beautiful two-bedroom apartment in Venice, California. I was traveling a lot for work and I just decided, you know what? I'm too comfortable. I have all of my needs met. Everything is kind of in place. And I'm not really growing enough in my environment. And I know this sounds crazy to some people because that's what everyone aspires towards, is being comfortable and not having to worry about, like, how am I going to pay my bills and da 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 da. And so I purposely jettisoned from that situation into not having anything. I gave away all my stuff. I moved out of my place. I don't have a car. I only have a backpack with whatever can fit into the backpack. So if it doesn't fit into the backpack, I can't bring it with me. So I've got a few days worth of clothing and I have to hand wash everything almost every day. And yeah, it's uncomfortable sometimes, you know, and it requires thought to figure out where am I going to stay next week or next month or, you know, trying to negotiate, you know, where am I going to find a routine in this city? How am I going to work out when I go to this place? And, you know, just trying to stay healthy and maintain things. It created a whole other host of challenges, but I call them happy challenges because, you know, we live in a world where, like, as we said earlier, things are constantly changing, twists and turns are happening. And what I found from just looking around is the people who are suffering the most are, I'm not talking about kids starving in, you know, whatever country. I'm talking about people in developed worlds who are suffering, because you could argue that they're suffering more or as much as someone who's starving, right? Obviously, you have to have your basic needs met. Once you have your basic needs met, though, the only reason you're suffering is because something around you is changing and you can't adapt to it. Some event has happened. You lost someone, you lost some money, you got fired, you got broken up with, right? Something happened, you couldn't adapt to it. And so you're still clinging to the past. Oh, this should have happened. It should have happened like that. I can't believe it. I wasn't ready. I wasn't prepared. So, and that's just a function of not putting yourself in situations where you had to deal with uncertainty more and more and more until it became your new norm. And that's what I'm essentially doing right now. And, you know, some people may look at it and, oh, that's very stoic. And it's just, but that's the nature of the world we live in. And so I'm doing it purposely as a sort of training to be in the moment and to stay in the moment when things aren't going the way that I want them to go. And as a result, what's happened is I don't really have a lot of suffering. I mean, obviously, again, I'm normal, I'm human, I have emotions and, you know, I have ups and downs and da 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 da. But I find that more often than not, I'm able to find a sense of gratitude, a sense of happiness inside that is not based on something happening on the outside. It's just because that's where I am and this is, you know, who I'm surrounded by. And so that coupled with, I've been writing these inspirational emails every day for the last almost 4 years. And so
every day,
not haven't missed one day.
Wow.
And that's been a really interesting exercise because it's
so for, where do you start? Like when you write that, because I can't imagine you sit down
and you're
inspired always
every
right?
day. Well, that's the thing. What happens is, you know, you get really good at finding the silver lining, the inspiration in almost anything, almost mm-hmm. any and everything. And so it's really hard to have a bad day when you've been doing that thousands of times. You've done it thousands. And I'll spend 2 or 3 hours a day on one single post, which is may only be 100 words or 200 wow. words. But it takes time to find the right one. Sometimes I'll write 5 of them in order to get to the one that I ultimately send out. And the one that I send out, maybe it starts off at 700 words and I have to whittle it down over many, many drafts to 150 words. And so you're thinking, you're spending a lot of focused time thinking about it. And people may say, well, where does he have all this time? You know, you create time based on your priorities. And that's one of my priorities, right? I still like, you know, dining out, and I still like, I date. I'm not a monk or anything like that. I'm very much in the world, but I prioritize. I don't spend a lot of time on social media. I don't spend a lot of time watching television. I don't watch Netflix very often. And, you know, I'm very much on a mission to help inspire people and teach people how to find happiness within. And so I spend a good amount of time of my day every day working on that. And I find that it feeds me. That's where I get my own inspiration, is from helping people. So yeah, it's been a really interesting experience. And this is my path. I'm not saying, you know, if you're listening to this, you need to quit your job and start writing inspirational emails or start, you know, becoming a nomad, but maybe there's something from this conversation that inspires you to do things in a way that feels aligned with where you are in your life. Maybe that means starting up some passion project that aligns with you, or having a conversation that could, you know, inspire you to do things a little differently. You know, so there's a thousand different ways to do this, and people have to find their own path.
So you gave that, you know, you gave yourself this practice because you're also, you know, an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I know that very well, being self-employed, mm. Means also self-employed all the time. So you have, you know, a whole day free. Nobody's going to call you and say like, Light, where are you? Why right. are you not at work?
Correct.
So where do you get your discipline from? So, you know, because I think this is one thing like all people who work from home, you know, have struggled with, you know, like, or like, where do you get this drive or commitment from to, for example, write for 4 years a daily inspiration?
Well, you know, that's something I wrote about recently and posted on my social media. I asked this one question. I said, what is your contribution? And what I'm essentially asking is, what are you agreeing to yourself to give back to the world? And once you have a clear answer to that question, my answer is inspiration and tools for happiness. So once I have the answer, that creates the agenda. And so the only question is, how can I do it? What are and then finding more and more efficient ways to do that, right? So I'm writing books, I'm creating blog posts, I'm posting on social media, I'm giving talks, I'm basically doing everything that I can to fulfill my mission. So if you're just working a job, right, then of course, yeah, you can't wait for Friday, Monday sucks, you know, and you spend the whole week thinking about what you're going to do over the weekend. And what I encourage everyone to do is to find a mission. It doesn't mean you have to quit your job, but just find a mission that hopefully you can integrate into your work. I mean, that'd be great if the 40 hours you're spending working can align with your mission to some extent. And the way I feel the thing works is when you do identify the mission, which is the answer to that question, what are you willing to give? What are you willing to contribute? And usually it's related to something you're already excited about. So, but there's a block, which is, oh, I could never do this full time. I could never, you know, we start telling ourselves the story about what we can't do, which is just a story. It's not true. You know, now if you had one leg, you know, then the story of I only have one leg, that's a true story. There's nothing you can do about growing your leg out, right? Not yet, at least. But if you say, I can't play football because I have only one leg, that's a story. That's not true. I'm sure out there, there's someone out there who has one leg, who maybe who has a prosthetic or some other way of playing football, right? Maybe wheelchair football. I don't know, but there's some way to do it. And so your mission could be finding that way to do it. If football excites you and you love the idea of it, it doesn't have to necessarily look like anything else that anyone else has created. You can create your own version. Maybe it's a video game that you create that gives people who only have one leg the simulation of having that experience, right? And I think that's our responsibility as humans, is to identify what it is that we want to contribute and allow that to become our mission. And it doesn't mean that it has to be the mission forever, just for now. It could just be for now, for this week or for this month or for this year, and commit to that. And every day you wake up, you think to yourself, okay, what can I do today that can allow me to push this mission forward? And that will give you your to-do list. And what you're going to ultimately find is that there's not enough time in the day to do all the things that are in alignment with your mission, because you're excited about it. You know, it's just like when you're excited about anything else, time flies, and you can get people enthusiastic about it because you're enthusiastic about something, and you just find yourself having these conversations, and you're not even trying to get people to help you, but they just offer to help you because they want to be a part of someone, of something that's usually bigger than someone just kind of trying to pay the bills and take things for themselves, right? So I feel like a lot of the world is geared around taking and trying to, like, you know, grind and hustle to make things happen for themselves. But when you really get to the business of contributing to helping people in some meaningful way, I think that's where you're going to start to see your real potential, and the level of creativity that you had no idea was inside of you is going to start to come out, because it's going to require that level of commitment to be able to move things forward, right? And a lot of that is going to bring about some uncertainty, so you want to be practicing some of that. A lot of that is going to bring about doubts and fears, because the world is not geared towards people doing this. The world is very much geared towards people falling in line and being on some assembly line and taking. And so that's going to be confronting, but you know, and that's again, that's why I'm doing the Nomad thing, is that it allows me to kind of move beyond that status quo normal conditioning that people tend to succumb to. And I become victim of that too sometimes, but if you practice it intentionally more and more and more, I think you'll find that it's easier to stay on mission and not deviate so far from whatever your purpose is.
So you already have given me a little bit of that answer to my next question, actually, which is, what is your answer to why are we here for? And you said giving, and giving from that place of what inspires us, shifting our perception to gratitude, you know, what we already have, being grateful, giving back, reaching a level of contentment. That's what I heard you saying so far. So would you add some things? What is your view on why are we here? Like,
I think that's a really great summary. And I think that, on some level, if we keep our focus on just helping other people, living our lives in some way that benefits other people, I think that we don't even have to know what our purpose is. We don't have to even ever articulate it for ourselves. We can just stay focused on helping people. And I think we'll naturally live in alignment with our purpose. And maybe one day, 50 years from now, you'll look back and you'll go, that was my purpose. Right. How often does that happen when you're in a situation, you think the situation is about one thing, and then time goes by and you look back and you see that it was a completely different lesson that you were getting from that situation? It happens all the time. And so I think even letting go of the need to find a why can be useful, right? If it's something that's kind of coming to you and it's clear, that's great. But that could be just one aspect. You know, I'm always reminded of the story of the seven blind men who were trying to describe the elephant. And one was underneath the belly and said the elephant's this big, round, robust thing. And someone was on the trunk and said the elephant's this narrow, kind of spongy thing. Someone was on the ear and said, no, this elephant, it's a flat, pancake-like thing. Someone was on the tail and said, no, it's a little stringy thing, right? Everyone was describing the elephant from their perspective, but no one was describing the elephant in its totality. And so I think our purpose is a lot like that. At different points in our life, we're in different parts of the elephant, but we're describing the same thing. And, you know, it's not important to necessarily articulate it. What's important is just listening to whatever's being communicated inside and to keep moving forward, to keep challenging ourselves to do whatever we're being called to do inside. And you know, the pieces of the puzzle will slowly come together day after day after day. And then at the end of our life, on our last day, whenever that day is, we'll look back and we'll see the whole thing, the whole picture. And we'll say, oh, that's what it was about.
Speaking of totality, so from the yogic tradition, there is, you know, a path you can walk on, you can progress on that. And this path is called Path of Awakening, right? So how does your tradition see that awakening? Is it a process, or do you think it's possible to actually wake up on a park bench?
Like Eckhart Tolle.
Right.
So I think the way that they would describe it in the Vedic meditation tradition is the process of self-realization, which is an unfolding, right? And it's an unfolding of awareness, meaning you're already that capital S big self is already there. It's already playing out. It's just that your little S self is becoming increasingly more and more aware of it. Day after day with more and more experiences. Now, I have an analogy that I use to kind of illustrate it, which is the light bulb, right? Let's say you have a 100 watt light bulb and it's been kind of neglected and it's gotten caked over with dust to the point where when the light bulb is supposed to be projecting 100 watts of light, because it has all the dust on it, it's only projecting what looks like 10 watts of light. So it's only accessing 1/10 of its potential. And so the casual observer may think, well, that light there, is something wrong with it. You know, sure, when it was born, it was bright and cheery, but now it's dim and dark and defunct. And so with practices like yoga, meditation, and therapy, and gratitude, and all of those inner work exercises, it's kind of like taking a little cotton swab and just cleaning a little bit of the light off here, a little bit there. Now, meanwhile, dust is falling every day, so the cleaning process needs to be as consistent as the dust falling process. But if you clean off more dust than is landing on the bulb, then eventually what will happen is the light will become brighter and brighter and brighter. Now, where did the bright light come from? The bright light was already shining from within. It's just that you're getting rid of the thing that's blocking it from coming out, which is the stress or the trauma or the whatever needs to be healed from the dust that's caked onto the bulb. And so eventually, with consistency, the light starts projecting its full potential, 100%, 100 watts. Now, if you have a room where a light is projecting all of its potential, that room and everything in the room will seem brighter, right? If it's only projecting 10% of its potential, there's a lot of darkness, there's a lot of shadows, there's a lot of scary looking things happening all around. And you can't quite make out what is that, you know, so all kinds of reasons for concern. But if there's a lot of light, then you can clearly see, oh, that's happening because this thing is over here and that's connected to this and there's nothing to be afraid of, right? So you have a sense of fearlessness as a result of the light's potential being fully realized, self-realized. So that's kind of what the self-realization process in my understanding is like. Is the potential is there, and as we do our inner work, we cultivate it so that our awareness becomes brighter and brighter and brighter, and then everything that's already around us, and we could be living in the exact same situation, but we're able to see things a lot clearer, and we're able to see connections and make distinctions and discern and prioritize a lot better, and then life gets better because of that. We're not bumping our knees into the things anymore because of all the darkness. We can see where we were stumbling before, and now we can make better choices.
Okay, last question. If today would be your last day, and you would have 3 messages for humanity to be left, things you've learned, things you want them to do or understand about life, what would you tell them?
Wow, that's a big question.
I know. Save the biggest for the last.
Wow, what are the 3 things I would tell humanity on this last day of mine? I would say that the answer is inside of you, not outside of you. It's inside of you. I would say to prioritize your meditation. Don't skip any meditations, because that's how you're going to find the answer. And I would say that the unknown is the safest place to go, and the known is the riskiest place to go. So favor the unknown.
Beautiful. Yay. Thank you so much, Light, for all of your time and wisdom and shared experiences. So where can people, you know, dig more into what you offer, with what you inspire? Sign up to your newsletter.
Yeah. So I would go to lightwatkins.com. I would sign up for the daily dose of inspiration. I would also sign up for the Light Watkins weekly. And I would also sign up for my monthly e-zine called The Daily Meditator. And I know that, you know, nobody wants to be spammed and, you know, have nonsense people selling stuff in their email box, but I really do try to give, because I hate that too. So I try to give a lot of value in my newsletters, and you'll definitely get inspired. You'll maybe laugh, and you'll be very informed about all the things happening in and around the community related to meditation, happiness, inspiration. So sign up for all 3 and then just unsubscribe from whatever you don't want after a couple of weeks. But I have a feeling you'll stick with all 3. And then follow me at Light Watkins on Instagram and on Twitter, and say hi. Tell me you found me through this podcast.
Yes, please. And you wrote a book.
I've written a couple books. One is called Bliss More, How to Succeed in Meditation Without Really Trying. That's the book I wish I had back when I was struggling with meditation in my first few years. And then I wrote another book called The Inner Gym, A 30-Day Workout for Strengthening Happiness, which is the answer to what we were talking about earlier, which is the emotional wear and tear of being so empathetic as a human, and how I can build up my inner happiness so that I can deal with all of these changes and information from all parts of the world and not be taken out of my own sense of happiness.
Mm-hmm. And would you say a few words about your last book, Bliss More?
Sure. Yeah. Bliss More is, it's been out for, about a year, maybe a little bit longer. And it's written for regular people. I do these trainings around the world. I do retreats, and it's wonderful. And unfortunately, working with people like me, it's kind of like buying organic food in the States. It's really expensive because there's just not that much of it. And it's a very analog process, and there's only one of me. So I can't be at all places. And I wanted to give more people who couldn't necessarily afford to travel to Bali and do a retreat with me the ability to still benefit from some of the principles and mechanics that I teach. And that was the intention behind writing the book, so that people can still get a decent meditation practice going, because there's a lot of conflicting information out there around meditation that I think could be really confusing for people. And I find that I'm not even exaggerating, but most people work too hard in meditation, and that ends up getting in their way. So Bliss More was a way to just simplify the practice, make it super, super simple, super accessible, so that you can start literally meditating almost right away and start enjoying the practice from day 1.
Beautiful. I'm really looking forward actually to read that book. It's already in my Amazon basket.
Perfect. So I wish I had a copy, but I can't fit it in my backpack.
I hoped so actually that you brought me one.
Yeah, but I don't have any.
You're traveling so minimalistic.
I can't even carry my own book. That's how minimalist I am.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Light, for your time again and for meeting me here in New York.
Of course. Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Yes, it was really fun. Great pleasure. Thank you so much. And
thanks to the listeners for tuning in.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And have a beautiful rest of your day. Maybe you meditate a little bit. And stay tuned and see you next week. Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, I'm happy if you follow the wonderful podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or YouTube. Share the podcast with your friends and leave a review while you're there. Because only with your support, the podcast can grow and inspire and uplift as many people as possible. Thank you for being here, and I wish you a wonderful time. And I hear you next week. Namaste.